Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. For most British citizens, their primary source of information about Israel and Palestine is from TV news bulletins. But academic studies have found a long-standing pro-Israel bias within the UK's broadcast media, resulting in a distorted version of reality being disseminated to the public. And the BBC, Britain's state broadcaster, is one of the worst offenders. So in today's programme, we're going to unpick the BBC's favourable predisposition towards the Zionist regime. I'll be asking two distinguished commentators for their views on this BBC bias after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
The BBC has been attacked by Zionists for its coverage of Palestine for many years. Recently, there has been a campaign to intimidate the BBC into backtracking on a report on a disturbance in London in December 2021. A bus of Jewish young people visited Oxford Street to celebrate Hanukkah, dancing beside a large menorah installed by the Orthodox Chabad Lubavitch sect. A confrontation developed with passing young Muslims during which anti-Israel slogans were voiced. The Board of Deputies claimed it as an anti-Semitic incident. The BBC led on that angle, but also reported anti-Muslim racial slurs were heard. In response, the Board of Deputies commissioned two companies and an academic expert to do the forensic analysis of the recording. Both claimed that the phrase "dirty Muslims" was not used, but that a Hebrew phrase calling for help was heard. The companies were D3 Forensics, a forensics company, and DigFind. Both are based in Hong Kong and seem to be one-man bands. The first has a minor web presence and a Twitter account with two followers. The second is an anonymous Twitter account and minor website. The director is on LinkedIn under the anonymous handle Mr. DigFind. His recent exploits include claiming that the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was admittedly killed by the occupation forces, was likely killed by a Palestinian bullet. The academic retained by the Board of Deputies was Australia-based Gilad Zuckerman. He has direct interests in the Zionist entity as visiting professor at the Weizmann Institute of Science. He has held a string of appointments at the universities in occupied Palestine. Zuckerman claims, "I'm not aware of any conflict of interest." And as if to cover himself, states, "I have no idea who these people are." In fact, Professor Zuckerman does have a conflict of interest. While at Oxford University, he was, in 1996 to 1998, the president of the L'Chaim Society. The L'Chaim Society was a part of the global Chabad Lubavitch movement. The bus at Oxford Street was from the Chabad Israeli Center Golders Green, one of more than 30 offices in London. Chabad members from occupied Palestine were on the bus. What is Chabad? It's a deeply racist Jewish supremacist organization. Its key theological tome, the Tanya, makes plain that the sect regards non-Jews as having animal souls. It has many followers amongst the most radical elements of the settler movement, the Hilltop Youth. Its leader there published the King's Torah, which declares killing Palestinian children is permissible since they may grow up to challenge the occupation. Even the Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, states that the rabbi's followers are responsible for most price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians, including murders. Did the kids on the bus condemn dirty Muslims? It would not be a surprise. This is the pedigree of the Hanukkah trip to Oxford Street and the Board of Deputies' laughable defence of it.
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Jackie Walker. Jackie is a political activist and a writer. She's the author of a family memoir, Pilgrim State, and the co-writer and performer of a one-woman show, The Lynching. She also has been a teacher and anti-racism trainer and was formerly the vice-chair of Momentum. She's joining us today via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, what can you tell us about the Board of Deputies investigation? I mean, you know the person behind it, don't you?
I do, yes. I mean, the person who commissioned these reports was a guy called Adam Mannett, and he used to work for Corporate Europe Observatory, which is an anti-corporate think tank in Brussels. And I know the people there quite well. I met Adam some years ago. And now he's working for the Board of Deputies as a lobbyist and in public affairs. And he's commissioning these, quite frankly, ridiculous reports from organisations which are said by the Board of Deputies to be highly reputable. Well, if reputable means that people have heard of them, they're not, because one of them's got 2 Twitter followers. I mean, it's incredible. The other one is a troll, a Zionist troll, followed by all the key Zionist trolls in this country. And so what you see here is an obvious propaganda ploy, which they've not even managed to cover up very well.
Yes, indeed. And interesting that the corporate media never take the Board of Deputies to task for those sorts of things. But Jackie, I mean, there was a huge outcry, wasn't there, over this Oxford Street incident. I mean, what was your impression of the mainstream media coverage in general and the BBC in particular?
Well, what was extraordinary in my mind about the way that it was covered was the turnaround that happened. And, I, for example, didn't know until you showed your film just now that what had happened is that those group of Orthodox Jews had been actually dancing and singing in the street. Now, actually, that kind of changes your perception on what it was. Because what we were told in the mainstream media was that this is just a group of Jewish young people going on a Hanukkah visit to do some shopping. So it seemed much more random, the whole thing. And that tells you something about the way it's always framed.
Yeah. I mean, David, you were just talking about the bona fides of these companies, these reputable firms that the Board of Deputies recruited. I mean, can it really be true that they're one-man bands?
Well, one of them, the troll who runs an anonymous troll account and who is on LinkedIn, the business networking website, as Mr. Digfind. He's anonymous on his own LinkedIn profile. I mean, he's a one-man band who recently said that Shireen Abu Akleh was killed probably by a Palestinian bullet. Well, the Israelis have already admitted that it was an IDF bullet which killed her. And the other company, which has this rather amateurish website, is run by one guy, according to our business directories. And there's another directory which says there may be another person who works there. It's not clear if they're the same person or not. So these are not reputable businesses. These are one-man bands. Who knows why on earth the Board of Deputies retain them to do the research. The research in itself isn't very controversial. All they do really is to say, yes, there's a video of this alleged incident, and it's genuine. The video is genuine. Well, no one's questioned the validity and genuineness of the video. The question is whether there is a Hebrew phrase in there saying, please get help, instead of the phrase which the BBC, which checked with 7 different journalists, heard, which was dirty Muslims.
I mean, does it suggest then that there's probably nobody else that they could find to actually, you know, do this sort of research for them because it's bogus?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I don't think we know that. But, I mean, it's like an incredible mess that they've made of this. They're trying to do some propaganda here to bully the BBC, which has been very, very effective. Mm. You know, when you actually look at it, it doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. I didn't know this until I had a little look, and all of a sudden the whole thing fell apart in front of me.
Incredible. Well, Jackie, tell us something about how the Board of Deputies actually operates.
Well, I was just going to kind of have a lead-on comment about that, really, because the reason they're effective is not because they've got evidence or use effective researchers or even tell the truth. The reason that the organisations like the Board of Deputies are actually effective is because they are never properly challenged. What they say is not challenged, and they go under this bogus sort of apparel of being a religious group. So people think they're like, I don't know, the Church of England or the Vatican or something like that, and then they're actually not. You know, they're basically a Zionist lobby group.
Sure. Doesn't that kind of undermine, really, the legitimacy of the Board of Deputies, do you think?
Yes, of course it does. But, it doesn't matter, because if they're doing the work that the establishment want them to do, they're not going to be questioned on it. Mm. So they're put on the BBC as the spokespeople for Jews. And even if you look at their membership and compare it with the population of Jews, it's obvious that they are not spokespeople for Jews in this country.
Sure. Well, David, we've discussed the extremist Chabad sect on this show before, haven't we? I mean, what's the connection here, and do you think it's significant?
Well, we have discussed Chabad, and as the film there showed, this is a really quite extreme sect, which is behind, as Chin Bet, the Zionist intelligence agency, says, most of the revenge attacks on Palestinians, including, you know, burning people's houses, killing people, actual murders. And yet this is an organisation which is all around the world. It's kind of a messianic organisation which tries to recruit people, from other parts of Judaism, but also from beyond the Jewish religion. But yet it's never regarded as being in any way extremist. But, even their basic theological doctrine, if you look at it, I mean, it's hair-raising. It talks about the fact that non-Jews have souls which are not like human, which are not human souls, they're animal souls. And the King's Torah, which is written by the rabbi who leads them in the hilltop in the settlements, talks about the permissibility, in fact, the fact that it's a good thing to kill Palestinian children. It's truly extraordinary. And this is an organisation which sent this bus to London, which has 30 offices in London alone and almost 100 in the UK as a whole. It's an organisation which has had no pushback, no proper coverage, no coverage at all, really, in the British press.
Right. Well, I think we'll just then move now to the next section, because we've got another report about how the BBC's systematically preferring to, as it were, put forward Israeli talking points.
All the scientific research on how the BBC deals with Zionism and Palestine shows that it's endemically biased against the Palestinians. The most comprehensive study showed a systematic preference for Israeli points of view. Israeli casualties were disproportionately reported. But this does not stop the Zionists pretending that the corporation is anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. The reporting of the events in Oxford Street in December 2021 is a key example. The Ofcom report on the incident was jumped on by the Jewish Chronicle, saying it slammed the BBC. The verdict was a victory for the JC. But it was no such thing. There was no claim that the BBC was wrong to report on the alleged racial slur, simply that it should have included the alternative views sooner once they emerged. Amongst other recent attacks have been claims of Jew hatred in the BBC Arabic service. It's not well known, but BBC Arabic has always been a propaganda service run directly in government interest. In fact, from the beginning in the 1930s, discussions between the Foreign Office and the BBC led to the omission of news which, in the view of the Foreign Office, would be inadvisable in times of crisis. This non-written agreement prevailed in the following six decades and is still valid up to the present day. It was the Foreign Office that directly funded a BBC Arabic TV service to compete with Al Jazeera from 2008. When Foreign Office cuts resulted in a planned secession, the FCO stepped in specifically to save the Arabic service in 2014. The campaign against the BBC is being led by the Jewish Chronicle, a paper with a decades-long history of ideological prejudice towards Muslims and a recent catalogue of defamatory stories. In 2020, there was a messy takeover battle won by a hardline Zionist consortium. It's led by Sir Robbie Gibb, who is now the sole owner of the company. Gibb has a history of working directly at the behest of Western intelligence agencies in subversion in the former Soviet Union. This was through a CIA and MI6-backed group called the Alliance of Russian Solidarists. He worked for the BBC for a number of years and then was spokesperson for Theresa May from 2017 when she was Prime Minister. In April 2021, it was reported Gibb would join the BBC Board of Governors. In August 2022, former BBC presenter Emily Maitlis stated that Gibb, an active agent of the Conservative Party, played a significant role in determining the nature of the corporation's news output. Gibb reportedly raised concerns about the BBC's reporting on the Oxford Street incident. His role in supporting, perhaps directing a campaign against the BBC is a flagrant conflict of interest.
David, in my opening remarks, I referred to academic research showing that the broadcast media bias results in kind of long-standing misreporting of Palestine. I mean, tell us about the research basis for that.
Well, I mean, the biggest studies were ones done at Glasgow University, where I used to work, at the Glasgow University Media Group, by Greg Filo and his colleagues there. And they show, as does almost all research which has been done, and certainly all legitimate research which has been done in this area, shows that it's Zionist talking points, Zionist frames of reference which are used on the BBC and by other broadcasters, including ITV and ITN in the UK, and that they give much more explanation to Israeli points of view than they do to Palestinians. They give more time to the Israelis than they do to the Palestinians. They don't explain why things happen in the territories and in occupation. So it's well known that the BBC and other broadcasters are biased systematically against the Palestinians. But, of course, that doesn't detain the Zionists, who nevertheless complain about rising trends of Jew hatred in the media and all this kind of thing, which is, you know, is palpable nonsense.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, the BBC's Panorama programme about alleged anti-Semitism in the Labour Party contrasted sharply with Al Jazeera's Labour files, didn't it?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, let's face it, the Panorama programme was a total travesty. From the way that it was edited, to the script that it ran through, to the people who were interviewed, who all came from one group, the Zionist Jewish Labour Movement. In fact, they didn't just come from one group. They were all from the executive, basically, of one group. Now, how do you call that a documentary? I mean, it's just pretty awful, really. And what's interesting about Al Jazeera is the fact that although that program was terribly undermined and ignored at the same time in the British media, we know that elsewhere it's actually very well respected. What we have here is a very vigorous propaganda war going.
Yeah. I mean, David, is it true that BBC Arabic has always been an instrument of the British Foreign Office?
It has. I mean, the BBC itself as an institution has had a close relationship historically with the British government. But BBC Arabic, specifically, it was always regarded as being just an arm of external propaganda by the Foreign Office. And that was the deal which they came to with the BBC in order that they would fund it directly. And when they stopped funding it in the 2000s, then the government made sure that an extra subvention was given because the Arabic service was regarded as being really very important for British propaganda purposes. So yes, of course, that's always been the case. And so then the idea that there are somehow anti-Israel sentiments being expressed in the BBC Arabic is just preposterous. But of course, that doesn't stop the coverage and the use of BBC Arabic as part of the attack on the BBC, which is being led by the JC.
No, indeed. Well, Jackie, tell us a little about the way the BBC covered Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party.
Well, I'll just give you one example, and it's probably the one of the best known ones, which was that awful interview about Corbyn, which had the backdrop of him with the Kremlin in the back, But in actual fact, it wasn't even just that. It was this mixture of both ignoring evidence, ignoring facts, ignoring alternative points of view, but also having some of the worst protagonists on and giving them an unchallenged, not just in terms of them being asked questions, but the airtime. I mean, it almost seemed at one point that we had everyday non-stop comments, for example, from Elman. It got so bad, I just turned BBC off because it was terrible, and I'm sure you remember that as well. It was incessant. Yes. The interesting thing is that now, you must know this story, that recently a Holocaust survivor has actually been constructively forced out of the Labour Party for actually trying to speak on Holocaust Memorial Day, and nobody in the media is interested in it.
No,
indeed. Extraordinary.
Indeed. Well, David, I mean, Robbie Gibbs' apparent involvement with MI6 is an interesting story, isn't it? I mean, tell us something about that. It's a rather bizarre episode, isn't it?
Well, this organisation, the National Alliance of Russian Solidarists, was a front group which was used, it was a right-wing Russian nationalist organisation, which was used by the CIA and indeed by MI6 back in the day. And they sent people in the early 80s. Robbie Gibb went, his brother Nick Gibb went, Julian Lewis, the chair of the Select Committee on Intelligence, was involved as well. And they went over there. In the 60s, MI6 was directly involved in it, but then MI6 withdrew from the project after they were exposed by Soviet intelligence. They realised they'd been burned. It looks like the MI6 probably got back involved later on, but we don't know that for a fact. It certainly was involved, quite a project which the CIA was directing for many, many years. So we don't really know if it was MI6 he was working for, or the CIA, or both. But even either way, we now find him involved with the JC, the sole proprietor of the JC.
Is it the JC, the Jewish Chronicle? Yeah.
Probably he's behind the campaign the JC is directing against the BBC, but he's also a governor of the BBC, and it must put him in an untenable position for that to be the case. In any democratic society, he would be sacked as a result of
indeed,
that.
Indeed, in Britain claims to be a democratic society, doesn't it? So it's rather extraordinary that he holds the position that he does. But Jackie, I mean, Robbie Gibbs' involvement with the Jewish Chronicle in the BBC, it ought to be an actual scandal, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not surprised about this at all, because what we've got to remember is that these people are doing the work of the establishment. The establishment are going to protect them. They're going to give them positions of power. And we see this happening in all our institutions and all our organisations. And that's what the real threat to democracy in Britain is today, I think.
David, I mean, Emily Maitlis, who used to work for the BBC, was a Newsnight anchor. I mean, what does she have to say about Robbie Gibb? She had some rather damning remarks, didn't she?
Jackie mentioned the Corbyn incident, where Corbyn was shown with the Kremlin in the background, and
I was on that show. I was the guest in the studio. It was a Newsnight. I should have picked it up, but I didn't.
And anyway, he photoshopped his hat.
I saw that after. I didn't notice on the day.
And Emily was, of course, the presenter of that day, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was.
She's now come out complaining about Robbie Gibb as being an active agent of the Conservative Party. I mean, it's not as if Emily Maitlis is a left-wing Corbynite, is it?
But no, indeed.
Nevertheless, she comes out and does that. And that's an indication, really, of the unease that there would be in the corporation with someone who is so ideologically conservative as Robbie Gibb. And so that's an interesting fact, isn't it, that unease is there. But nevertheless, these people simply run the show.
Mm. What's the game, though, here, David? Because, I mean, you were saying earlier on that, it's well-known that, that kind of bias, as it were, in favour of Israel. And yet, we're seeing these attacks against the BBC. Some are suggesting that they're not.
Well, it's well-known in the sense that it's well-known in the academic literature.
Yes.
Right? Now, in public debate, it's not so well-known. So that's the issue.
Right, OK. Well, unfortunately, as usual, we could spend a lot longer, but we're out of time again today. I want to thank our guests, Jackie Walker, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. As we've explained in today's programme, the corporate media corporate broadcast media fails to accurately report the situation in Palestine and promotes Zionist talking points. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The U.S. experienced more than 600 mass shootings in 2022, nearly double the number recorded 4 years ago when there were 336. This was reported by the Washington-based Gun Violence Archive. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crossing international roads, Americans not only kill other people by the millions, at least 32 million have been killed since 2001. They also kill their own by the tens of thousands. In 2022, the nonprofit group Gun Violence Archive recorded 43,789 deaths in 2022 related to gun violence in the U.S. Even children are not spared, as the latest figures released by Gun Violence Archive GVA on December 27, 2022 showed. At least 6,032 children, 17 years or younger, have been killed or injured in 2022 so far, according to GVA data. The GVA figures for 2022 showed that 306 children, 11 years of age and younger, died by gunfire. Another 668 were injured. The figure for age bracket 12 to 17 provide an even more horrifying picture. 1,325 deaths and 3,732 injuries due to gunfire. This is the highest number of gun-related casualties since the GVA started keeping a record in 2014. The 2022 figures mark a notable increase in number of deaths and injuries since last year, when 5,708 casualties were recorded across the U.S. So far, there have been 609 mass shootings in the U.S. up to November 2022, according to GVA figures. Will these figures reach more than that number by the end of the year 2023? To equal the highest number of shootings recorded in the U.S., schools across the U.S. have also been targeted. On May 24, 2022, one of the most horrific school mass shootings occurred at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Salvador Ramos, 18, entered the school and barricaded himself in a classroom where he shot and killed 19 students aged 7 to 10 and two teachers. Before arriving at the school for his shooting spree, Ramos had also shot his grandmother. She was admitted to hospital in critical condition where she died. Ramos was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents and UCISD officers after they breached the classroom. Families of the victims of Uvalde school shooting have since launched a class action lawsuit against local and state police, the city, and other school and law enforcement officials seeking $27 billion due to delays in confronting the attacker, court documents show. The lawsuit filed in Austin, Texas, states that law enforcement officials failed to follow active attacker protocol when they waited for 77 minutes before confronting the attacker inside a fourth grade classroom. While the most recent school mass shooting evolved was not the most horrific, it was preceded by such other school shootings at those as Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut on December 14, 2012, and the Virginia Tech shooting in Blacksburg, Virginia of April 16, 2007. At a Sandy Hook Elementary School, 20-year-old Adam Lentz arrived with four guns. He entered a first grade class where he shot and killed 20 children aged 6 and 7, along with six adults, including four teachers, the principal, and the school psychologist. Two other people were injured. He also shot himself before the police arrived. In the Virginia Tech shooting, 23-year-old student Song Hoi Cho killed 32 students and faculty members in two separate attacks on campus. He also injured 17 others before committing suicide. On April 20th, 1999, a school shooting and attempting bombing occurred at Columbine High School in Columbine, Colorado, that came to set an example for mass shootings at schools across the U.S. The perpetrators were two 12th grade students, Eric David Harris and Dylan Bennett Klebold. They murdered 12 students and one teacher before they committed suicide. It was the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history at the time. Texas, Florida, and California have also recorded multiple school shootings. China Daily also reported in 2022 the U.S. again led the world in gun-related deaths, more than 20,900, including homicides and suicide, Gun Violence Archive says. And the U.S. has the highest number of guns per capita at more than 400 million weapons, meaning there is more than one gun for every man, woman, and child. Richard Burke, a professor emeritus of criminology and statistics at the University of Pennsylvania, told the Washington Post, "Many other countries have disadvantaged folks who are angry and alienated. But guns aren't there. Mass shootings in the U.S. have followed a predictable and superficial script, with a few exceptions. They produce calls for greater gun controls, including banning automatic weapons. Gun advocates defend the right to bear arms. There are instant monuments to victims, and there are candlelight vigils. The media profiles the victims and the shooter. The shooter's Facebook page or blog will be found, and perhaps a note giving a hint of why the shooting happens. And there are heartfelt comments from politicians from the local level to the White House." China Daily added, "With few exceptions, most of the shootings fade from the national conversation, but the scenario unfolds again. when the new one occurs. There are those who offer a radical solution. Arm good guys to take on bad guys, and that is what is happening in the U.S. The increase in the number of public shootings involving guns is causing people to arm themselves out of fear. Gun sales peak after mass shootings, partly for fear of victimization and partly for fear of increased regulation. They rose after school shootings amid coronavirus shutdowns, racial justice protests, the presidential election in 2020, and after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. There is deadly gun violence in the U.S. every day, and mass shootings, especially in schools, draw much more attention. However, those shootings represent a fraction of gun violence overall, said Gillian Peterson, an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and co-founder of the Violence Project, which studies mass killers. Mass shootings, Peterson told the Post, account for fewer than 1% of all people killed by firearms. They are very rare still, even though they're increasing. Mass shootings by design are meant to go viral, Peterson said. The goal of them is fame, notoriety. Public mass shootings have a psychological impact on people, instilling fear of going to movies or a grocery store, she said. While mass shootings draw attention, most gun deaths in the U.S. are either suicides or homicides, according to federal figures, with accidental or unterminated gun deaths, representing a small fraction of the overall share. Almost 60% of gun deaths each year are suicides, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention says.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of purification according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. You know, having made a wudu with the intention of having wudu for the prayer of Maghrib, right?
Yes.
Is it permissible? Does it give us, in fact, this permission to also touch the Noble Quran with that wudu and offer the prayer of Isha, for example, with the same wudu? I mean,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think the issue is very clear, since we do know that if we make one wudu, it is sufficient for every religious act that requires wudu or tahara.
Yes.
So basically, once a valid wuzu is made and it has not become invalid through one of those invalidating agents, it is always and absolutely permissible to perform any act that requires wuzu, whether it is touching the Holy Quran or the script of the Holy Quran, or offering any other prayers with it.
Doesn't it make a difference whether to make, for example, a general intention or versus a specific intention? Like, for example, when you specify your intention to having the wudu for the prayer of Maghrib, does it give you that permission to also offer the prayer of, for example, other times?
Yes, of course. You know, irrespective of whether you make a general niyyah,
with the general niyyah or intention, that's fine.
That's
what
fine,
about the
you know,
specific?
Because
ones?
There are many people who still wonder as to whether it is permissible to offer prayer with a wudu, which is mustahab, for example.
Right.
Like, for example, it is always recommended to be in a state of ritual purity, and wudu is one of the means of ritual purity. Now, ghusl is also another means of ritual purity through which purification is achieved. Now, if a person makes a general niyyah that, okay, I'm going to make wudu simply to stay in and to be in the state of tahara, and then he wants to offer, perform prayers with the same wudu, the same mustahab wudu, that's fine. You know, he can offer the Maghrib prayer or Isha prayer or any other prayers, whether mustahab or wajib, that it does not make any difference. Now, when it comes to your question, you just said that, okay, if one makes wudu to offer with the intention of performing Maghrib prayer and then he wants to offer with the same wudu,
yes,
another prayer which is Maghrib, of course, that's fine because the tahara is there, mm-hmm, the ritual purity. What is important is tahara and ritual purity, which is already there. And it doesn't make any difference as to what you are going to do, whether you touch or the script of the Quran, or mm-hmm, whether you are going to do any sajda or recite the Quran or perform a wajib prayer.
I see. You know, Sheikh Chabit, some people need to wear wigs or artificial hair, right? Either for beauty or for, like, the cold, for example. Well, if a person has to wear artificial hair on his head and it, you know, it's sometimes becoming difficult, actually, to get it off, to,
yes,
pull it off, right?
Sure.
So they need it on them all the time. So is it permissible for them to wipe over it because they have to do mass in wudu?
Yeah, it's one of the frequently asked questions. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that if the artificial hair is in the form of a wig, of course, it would be obligatory to remove it because it forms a barrier. It forms a kind of obstruction, which must be removed, because when you want to wipe on the front part of your head, then that wig will form a barrier which will not allow the moisture to reach the scalp or the skin of your head.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be removed. And this is an answer given by all religious authorities, as far, mm-hmm, as I know. None of the religious authorities allow the wig to be there, and it must be removed. But if the artificial hair is implanted in the skin and its removal, entails unbearable difficulty or hardship or a kind of, undue hardship, you know, you can say it usr haraj, which in mm-hmm, Farsi or in Arabic they call it. And so, in that case, of course, it's because of the difficulty that it entails, it would be permissible and valid to, mm-hmm, do the wiping or the,
yes,
mass over it. And His Eminence also says that the precaution is to perform tayammum also in the same case, because that you cannot remove the hair. On the other hand, the hair is there and you can't help it. It's there. So the precaution is to perform tayammum at the same time.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chabit is still our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of purification or tahara. With Sheikh Chabit. Sheikh Chabit, before the break, I asked you a question about the artificial hair. But how about the other artificial, things, such as, for example, legs or arms? How do the duty bounds go about them in wudu?
Well, there shouldn't be any kind of barrier while making wudu, and one should make sure that there is no impediment or no obstruction, nothing to obstruct the water from reaching the skin. And so, for example, if
one person, for example, doesn't have one foot or one leg.
Yes.
So has he, does he have to, like, for only do the mass, for example, one of his foot?
Of course.
Right?
Yes. He should do so. But we are talking about certain things which might prevent water from reaching the skin. Like, for example, a painter, you know, a painter who paints cars or walls, or, you know, because he is always in touch with dye.
Yes.
And so the paint will definitely form a barrier. So such people who have paint on their hands or maybe on their toes, they should make sure that there is no paint at all.
Mm.
And so should they should remove the paint. That the same is the case with ladies who, for example, use nail polish. Some people nail polish is definitely a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And ladies should understand that, okay, they have to remove the nail polish before making wudu.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is the case when they perform ghusl, because nail polish does prevent water from reaching the nail plates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the nail plates. So this is the case. But there are some kinds of nail polish which are called water permeable, and they are also called water friendly, which is claimed. They are the nail polish is claimed to be allowing or to allow water to go through the paint and reach the skin.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not proven. That's not the case, because it's very difficult to prove whether to make sure that the water reaches the skin or the nail plates. And because the paint is already there, the paint, where does the paint stand? It is on the skin. So how can the water reach down the paint and reach the skin? That's very difficult to prove. So in order to make sure that water definitely reaches the skin or the nail plates, it is necessary to remove the polish.
What about the long hair that some people have?
Long hair is not a barrier. It's not a barrier. It's not a problem.
What about the hair which is planted?
Okay. Some...
Should we consider it as our own hair?
Yeah, of course, because we have natural hair. And we have also synthetic or artificial hair.
Yeah, synthetic.
We are not talking about artificial hair, because we talked about it. We said that it's a barrier. It mm-hmm. should be removed. And one
right.
should, if that's not removable, it should one should perform them. But
true.
when it comes to natural hair, of course, the natural hair which is planted, because mm-hmm. in this time around, we see that the doctors, the surgeons
exactly.
who plant natural hair, that's natural hair. You know, it does not form a barrier. And you can go ahead and wipe you on the front part of your head without any problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Shavi. Thank you very much for listening to us, listening to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We talked about some of the rules of tahara or purification. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.